Group meeting, Sunday, 14th February, 1982. This is our anniversary weekend. The very first meeting of these groups started on Saturday, the 10th of February, 1962. More people began to come in, and so we started a Friday group in July 1962. And later on, another demand was made, and we started the Sunday group in September 1963. And I'm very happy to see one of our founder members, Dick Patterson, present today to celebrate this 20th anniversary of the Sunday groups. So 20 years have passed by with three meetings on Friday, Saturday and Sunday for each of the weekends as such. In the early years, we had our meetings every fortnight. But with the passing of the years and the passing of my energies and abilities, I was compelled to decrease the number of meetings. Up to date, we have had 346 Friday meetings, 365 Saturday meetings. We talk about a month of Sundays, but we can now talk, as far as the Saturday group is concerned, a year of Saturday groups. And 327, including this one, for the Sunday meetings. So altogether, we have had, when we finish today's meeting, we shall have had 1,038 meetings in this house, which is very nice for the house. And I'm extremely grateful to all of you through the years who have contributed to making the atmosphere of this room and this house. Because believe me, unless all of you had come, and you come freely and willingly and helpfully, this room would not have the atmosphere that so many people notice. People who are complete strangers, they after a few moments, they said, "It's a curious atmosphere here." You see? Now, in addition to these meetings, we have held 15 summer schools altogether. At a house in St. Margaret's Bay, which belonged to two of our members who don't come to these meetings now, but who come only to the Krishnamurti group meetings. Then we have had about two or three at the house of Morris and Joan Dashwood in Cobham. Then we have had about three small summer schools here in this house. And of course I used to cook a rather spicy oriental curry for them and so forth. And we used to have the midday meal downstairs. But we couldn't take more than 22 at the most. After all, with tables and all the rest of it, you can't cram in too much. So then we have had summer schools at Catherington House in Horndean, near Portsmouth. Some of you were there. And at Park Place several times at Wickham. And two at Giltalian Community Centre, St. Mary's House, Buxted. And last year at the Cenacle, Greyshot, Hindhead. So we have had 15 summer schools in England. And I have, of course, done other summer schools in Germany, in Elmau. But I'm only talking about what we have done here in these 20 years. Now, all these summer schools, at these summer schools, group members have made valuable contributions with talks discussions, music, and organizing and other services. Altogether at the summer schools, there have been 136 talks, including 8 by group members, amongst whom, and also including 2 guest speakers, John Moore, the publisher of The Heart of Religion, and the late Stanley Jeeves, who had a very brilliant and very attractive subject based on the life of Mozart, and he called it Amadeus, and it consisted of lots of slides. Were they moving pictures or slides? Do you remember, those of you who were there? They were slides, yes. Slides and music, Mozart's music. And it was all wonderfully built up. It's rather sad that he died of heart failure suddenly just a couple of years, 2 or 3 years back. He was such a nice man. He was doing such excellent work. But there we are. Now, to one and all, as far as all these meetings and summer schools are concerned, our grateful thanks. I'm not using our in the regal sense, but I mean gratitude from all of us to all of us, because we are mutually grateful to each other in all that we attempt to do with understanding and with love and in terms of a complete harmony. Over 350 people, different people, have come and gone. More than 250 have quite evaporated. Some came because of sheer curiosity. Others found that it was not their cup of tea, and so they departed in peace. Then there were some, of course, who died. Only 2 of the younger folk and 2 90-year-olds. Mrs. McConnell was one, remember, Dick? Mrs. McConnell died, and Mrs. Perrett. Both were 90. And they died. And I can't remember any others besides that.
Arnold Kagan died.
Yes. Doctor. He died recently, yes. Well, he wasn't very young, but he was 77.
Was he?
Yes. Quite surprising, isn't it? I didn't think he was 77. And he was 77. So we had, 3 of the older people who died. Now I want to say a few words about the spirit which animates us here, the kind of spirit which animates us. In ancient India, there was no advertising whatsoever with regard to the spiritual life, especially any self-advertising. I mention this because it grieves me to see, and I feel ashamed to say, that so many of my countrymen have fallen prey to this passion for making money out of the life of the spirit. One has to, particularly to travel in a country like America, and see the magazines which advertise these wonderful yogis, some of whom are not light brown, not only not dark brown in color, or just light brown, but they are quite white in color, and they have wonderful Indian names too. You see, yogi so-and-so, yogi so-and-so. And they make a wonderful business out of it, commercializing the spirit, the money changers in the temple of the Lord. Beware of that. Whenever you see any self-advertising of any sort with regard to a spiritual teacher who sets himself up as a teacher, keep far away from him or her, as the case may be. Make no mistake about it. The true spiritual teachers and yogis lived in forest hermitages on the outskirts of villages near to a stream. Perceptive, sensitive people from the villages and from nearby towns and even big cities, seriously concerned with living the religious life, recognized these teachers by their obvious personal purity and saintly lives. What those teachers said, that they accomplished, that they did. As they spoke, so they acted. The truth they had realized, they gave to the truth lover who had proved his worth to receive the truth. Those teachers asked for no fees. They touched no gold. They sought no public honors or fame of any sort. So you see the sort of spirit in which the teaching was given out, completely freely to all who came to them. They were tested, of course, whether they were fit for living the religious life. It is by no means easy to take to the religious life in the real sense of the word. It is quite easy to observe outward rituals and ceremonials and whatnot, but that is not the religious life. The religious life fundamentally is this perpetual, this constant mindfulness in the true sense, in the deep sense of the word mindfulness. That is the essential aspect, plus the indispensable element of the perfect moral life, morality. And you can add to that, if you like, the life of truly good sense. So many people who are sincerely interested in the religious life tend, in certain ways at least, to take leave of good sense. Well, if you take leave of good sense, give up all pretense to wanting the religious life at all. Those teachers lived the holy. They lived the holy life in the full sense of the term. They were people who had realized their complete reintegration with the transcendent totality. Now, this is no small thing to say, but you know how in the lives of the great founders of the religions, they have openly declared that fact. Jesus said, "I and the Father are one." That was his affirmation of transcendence. The Buddha made his affirmation of transcendence in his own more philosophical and more soundly psychological manner. He didn't use the personalistic, theistic terms as such. Zarathustra made the same. Sri Krishna openly declared that he was the Lord of the universe and so forth. And so we have these great teachers affirming the fact. And if you read, if you study the Rig Veda carefully, and also the Upanishads, particularly the Upanishads very carefully, you will find that these great teachers did declare themselves as and when the right situation arose. Otherwise they didn't, otherwise they would be just bragging about themselves. So there was none of that, absolutely none of that. Therefore these teachers were a benediction to their people and to their environment. The people, for their part, out of gratitude, saw to it that the minimal necessities for existence of these teachers were satisfied. Note carefully, just the minimal necessities of existence. And let us not think that, yes, but they didn't have the sort of cold climate and all the rest of it which we have here. Go and live in northern India and you'll find 3 months of the year in which you will shiver. I've lived in northern India for just over a year and I know what it is like. Very good. Now, our concern here all these years has been the art of living the religious life. No particular faith is emphasized or exalted above any other faith. Nor do we regard all faiths as equal. Each is unique. The idea of equality is a very misleading idea, especially where the transcendent is concerned. And religion, the context of religion, is the context of transcendence itself, none other. The context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. How will you measure the infinite? How will you compare one aspect of eternity with another aspect, assuming there could possibly be more than one aspect of eternity? This is the realm of the immeasurable. It is the realm also of the indescribable. It is the realm which utterly transcends our ordinary, worldly, finite, temporal, and mortal realm. Completely transcends it. And moreover, it is the infinite, the eternal, which wholly subsumes this which is finite and mortal. If that were not the case, and the Buddha affirmed that it was, when he said that if there were not the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, the uncompounded, there could be no possible release from this here, which is the born, the made, the become, the compounded. You see? So in that realm completely subsumes this. This realm and all that this realm holds, that is the total manifested universe, and our world, our planet, with all its different kingdoms of nature, as we call them, and including ourselves, we are as the different garments which are worn by that which is the one and only absolute total reality. We are but garments, and just as we cast away garments when those garments are outworn, so too each of us dies when his or her usefulness and place and necessity for existence is finished with. Then he dies. And he dies absolutely and completely. And it was the Buddha who was the first to affirm that. None of the other teachers presented it that way. They were under the great difficulty of the mass of the people wanting to have their particular ego, their particular identity persisting throughout time. Now, persistence throughout time, as such, is quite impossible, for the simple reason that time implies change, perpetual change, and there is no such thing as a constant, identifiable identity entity in the whole universe. Everything completely changes, and when that change is a change not of mere transformation, a mere change of outward form and substance and so on, but it is a true transmutation, and this can take place only in a human being, as far as this planet is concerned, a true transmutation of mind and consciousness. This mind and consciousness, which is limited, and in suffering and difficulty and in confusion and conflict and so on, here in this world, is at one with that infinite, eternal, transcendent, all mind, which is the great directive force which enables a cosmos to emerge out of a chaos. So we must bear that in mind very, very carefully, and It'll give us an idea of how we should approach religion and the religious life. The approach means that everything which pertains to separate, isolative selfness has to be utterly done away with, not by destroying it. We are as we are at the moment, full of selfness, self-centered, self-oriented, self-concerned. But If we live the religious life in the true sense, we will undergo that transmutation by which this tendency of ours to draw the world unto ourselves will be utterly changed, utterly transformed into giving ourselves totally and completely, unreservedly and unconditionally to the transcendent real, the totality itself. Then one has lived the religious life in the religious sense, wholly and completely. If I'm not mistaken, I think there are one or two Western philosophers, I believe Spinoza was one of them, who had that sort of outlook. And in a peculiar way, Voltaire, with all his biting wit, presented ideas somewhat similar to that. I'm not quite certain about it. During my lifetime, I've read so much that it's difficult to retain everything. I would have to re-study what I read in my younger days. Now, so we do not emphasize or exalt any faith above any other, nor do we regard them as equal, all of them as equal. They are all unique. That is the important point. All who come here come freely. They are equally free not to come. There is no compulsion, there is no expectation, no hope that such and such a person who has come here today will come again tomorrow or whatever it is. You are utterly free. I think those who have come will bear that out. Out of the more than 350 who have come and gone, there has emerged a sort of a steady core of about 80 people. But you all come freely and willingly. At least I hope you do. No beliefs or rituals or systems of thought or meditation are imposed. In considering the living of the religious life, we do not get ourselves enmeshed in intellectualist discussions about doctrines and dogmas and so forth. That is just intellectual pleasure lust being gratified. That's all. It's purely an intellectual pleasure lust. In my lifetime, and I'm in my 80th year now, in my lifetime, I have experienced dozens of different societies and groups of people, well-meaning, yes, but not altogether wise or really possessed of something like a clear vision of what religion and the religious life means. And hour after hour they spend in discussions and arguments and so forth, magnificent displays of intellectuality and so on, but the real spiritual substance, the livingness of the religious life, was not there at all. So, of course, naturally, I slipped away from all of them. To put it in schoolboy terms, I couldn't stand that nonsense. Now, if members feel... another point. There are no fees of any sort demanded or expected. And I do not believe even in putting out a begging bowl for expenses and so forth. Why should I? As long as I was earning my own livelihood and could manage the whole thing, we did it. It has to be completely free and open. If I were to charge fees and so forth, I would always be under a certain constraint. I couldn't speak absolutely freely, and I think you'll bear out, I have spoken extremely freely and extremely radically, the way I have altogether thrown out cherished beliefs, heaven, hell, rebirth, karma, and the petty little misinterpretations of karma which have existed century after century. All those have gone by the board. And you all, and some of you at least, know about that. There is, I am completely in line with the Buddha's teaching in this respect, that there is no such thing as the survival of personality in any shape or form. The personality is completely gone forever and ever. Therefore, there cannot be a reincarnation which would imply an identifiable entity. But as with the Buddha, I do hold that there is no such thing as annihilation. You can't annihilate anything in the cosmos. There is only a process of transformation, that is a mere changing about of the shape and the form and so on, or there will be a true transmutation. If at any time you get a touch of transcendence in your own inner life and consciousness, you will know what I'm talking about. It's something so extraordinary that it completely throws overboard dozens of cherished beliefs and ideas. It's very distressing. I suppose I have been through intellectual distress as few of you have ever been through. You may have been through greater emotional distress. After all, I'm an ordinary man, a nobody. And I've gone through life just like many people do, go through life with all its difficulties and problems, sorrows and sufferings and deprivations of all sorts. But what's all that? It doesn't matter. When you can really let go, then the whole world comes flowing into you. But you must really let go, not merely as an external psychological technique in order to satisfy the deeper hidden greed of getting the whole world for yourself. Beware of these subtle things in the psyche. Beware of them. So, no fees are expected or demanded. If members feel happy to express their gratitude and appreciation by giving money or fruit as a free gift, please don't start bringing aspidistras or all sorts of objects or books or book tokens or any sort of tokens like that. They are useless to me. You see, after all, I'm trying to get rid of things and antique furnitures and whatnot and books and everything. I'm trying to get rid of them and to be free of the burden of possessing them. In any case, the government will come down with tax for dying, you see. So it's best to possess nothing. Those who give, as well as those who do not or cannot, because of their circumstances, give anything at all, are all equally welcome. As long as I live, so will it be, here in this house anyway, for the spirit, like love or wisdom or beauty, cannot be bought or sold. Remember that those old teachers, all of them, not only in India, but all over the world in those days, 2,000 and 3,000 years and 4,000 years ago, they carried this thing out, you see. The people gave, and they were poor people, most of them. There were occasionally kings too who came. There are several kings mentioned in the Upanishads. And the Buddha, for instance, had amongst his followers King Seniya Bimbisara of Magadha, a small kingdom roughly the size of Britain, and King Pasenadi of Kosala, also another kingdom about the size of England, modern England, or maybe a little bit larger. They used to come to the Buddha and sit at his feet and show their reverence by stroking his feet, touching his feet, and kissing his feet, and so forth. So the Pope is not the only one whose toe is kissed by the devotee. This thing happened through the ages. as long as I can maintain this situation here, independently, I will continue to serve you wholeheartedly. Please note, to serve you. I am your servant. Don't regard me as anything else. If you want to regard me as anything else, call me your fellow student, provided you yourself are a serious-minded, good student. So I consider myself a good student. That's my conceit. And good studentship means that all the time you are sufficiently open-minded and sufficiently ungrasping to let go that which you see is not the highest truth. That is important. I am your fellow student, not your teacher. I shall never accept the ascription of teacherhood for myself. I shall never accept that. We learn together. If not for you, I would not know this, that, or the other. I learn from you, I learn from everything all the time. We can all be learners together. Who is our real teacher, then? Life itself is our teacher. Life itself. And the book of life, written each day by each and every one of us, is our scripture, our holy book. Now this is of the utmost importance. You remember what the Buddha said towards the end of his life? Be a lamp unto yourself. I would reiterate that and say, be lights unto yourselves. Be lights unto yourselves after the fashion of the stars in heaven. Be like the stars in heaven. The stars are self-shining lights. This is the important thing. The light from within. And how does that light come out from within the star? Because the star completely expends itself, burns itself out in performing all it, in fulfilling its proper place and its particular business in the entire cosmos. What a lesson there is. You have only to look out of your window on a cloudless night and see those stars and learn from that. Burn away, therefore, in soul living that transcendence itself fulfills itself through each and every one of us finite temporal mortals as man. Capital M, capital A, capital N. As the perfect man. And it is this man which is referred to really, but I think the whole of Christendom is unaware of it, is referred to in the first chapter of Genesis, when in the 25th and 26th verses it is said, and Elohim said, let us create man in our own living likeness. Elohim, which is translated as God, cannot be a particular man or a superman or any such thing. And Elohim, the ultimate creative energy in itself, is of a nature which is utterly unlike us who are constituted of matter and so forth. And therefore, when you get that sentence, if you can meditate and really enter into the deep depths of its meaning, you will realize what man implies. It implies that this which we call the absolute mind, the pure mind, the Christ consciousness or the Buddha mind, or use any phrase you like, the Vahumano of the Zarathustrians and so forth, that comes to fruition through each of us as individual mortal human beings. This is very important to realize. If you can see things like this, if you can really see them, don't take them as so many thoughts. Thoughts just by themselves are impotent. They are really impotent. They can't do anything. They can help. They can give you just that little nudge or just that little alluring call to spur you on to do the real work. But doing the real work is the important thing. All right. So, be like the stars, self-shining lights. And remember that the stars are separated from each other by immense distances. Immense distances. Thousands, some of them are thousands of millions of light years away. And one light year is approximately 6 million miles. Where distance is concerned in space. Now you see what our task is like. We have to learn to be the alone, not lonely. Loneliness is due to self-pity, essentially. The circumstance is difficult. It arouses self-pity and so forth. It is due to our own insufficiency where we are concerned. We are not lights to ourselves. We are not the source of sustenance, spiritual, intellectual, psychological and materials. So we feel lonely and miserable. That is not being alone. Being alone means that you are the fulfilled human being through whom transcendence has realized itself as man and what man stands for. Now, there are several other things we might just touch upon. It is sometimes useful to take stock of ourselves. Now, 20 years have gone by, and it might be, of course, 20 years haven't gone by for all of us. Yesterday, there were newcomers, and I think today we have one or two newcomers who have been here only an hour, whereas an hour is not equal to 20 years. But so many years have passed by. It was useful to take stock of ourselves. Take stock where certain points of fundamental importance are concerned. Are we somewhat, not entirely, but somewhat quieter? I say somewhat quieter and not entirely for the simple reason. Why? Just observe what we do when we meet in the other room for tea. Are we quiet? Have we a little more equanimity, calmness of mind, a little more inward balance, poise, and therefore the ability combined with the quietness to stand back and observe carefully? Are we more perceptive? Sensitive? Do we understand ourselves? Have we grown in self-knowledge? This is a point of very great importance, because without self-knowledge there is no possibility whatsoever of having the necessary vision to see the direction in which life is moving us. We simply can't see it. We may use words like the infinite, the eternal, and they're all grand sounding words, or God, or Nirvana, or the kingdom of heaven, or whatever you like to say. But it's all verbiage, just downright verbiage. The brain may perhaps form some restricted picture of what these words stand for, but you don't really know what you're talking about. Or thinking about. That is the point. The real knowing is a realization in innermost consciousness of the fact of infinity or eternity or transcendent love or wisdom. And how will you test out whether you really know it in, you really have it in your inner consciousness? If you have it really in your inner consciousness, your whole outward life of feeling, thinking, speaking, and doing will bear the evidence of that transcendent reality. Do our lives represent transcendence? You see, that is how we can test out. No other person can tell you that particular aspect with regard to yourself. For the very simple reason that unless a person himself is a Christ or a Buddha, and therefore in consciousness able to be completely at one with your consciousness, he doesn't know what is inside even this little box here. Of course, with so many people, that little box is empty. But there we are. So, growth in self-knowledge. Are we free from bias and prejudice, preconception and assumption? Because all preconceptions and assumptions, without exception, have no warrant whatsoever in terms of ultimate religious truth. No warrant at all. As and when this ultimate religious truth is realized, what you do is to be completely silent, and you will speak only when someone who is in real need and seriously needing your assistance will come to you, and then you will say the fewest possible words. You ought to turn around upon me and tell me, you pour out words by the 100 dozen per hour. Are we harmonious inside ourselves, natural and spontaneous? The world today has rapidly become natural and spontaneous in the wrong way altogether. It has become permissive. It has just become not animalish but bestial. Animals are good creatures. They are moral creatures. They are intelligent creatures. But mankind today, all over the world, has really degenerated in the most appalling way. And it is going headlong towards the edge of the precipice. You can be the influences which will save mankind. But first you have to be saved yourself. You must be saved from within. Saved means salved, healed, made whole, made holy. And that can only come from within yourselves. So, are we free from greeds and lusts, hates, fears, violence, illusions, delusions, and so on? Are we free of clinging to what is passing, and everything in the manifested universe is passing and perishing all the time? And if we cling to it, we just become miserable perishers ourselves, instead of living life as vigorous, innocent. Innocent means harmless, innocens, not harming, as innocent human beings in the true sense. And are we free of grasping at the new or at any objectives that we may think of, whether worldly or unworldly? Beware of unworldly ambitions. They do more harm than worldly ambitions in the long run, because they destroy the possibility of a pure character. Unworldly ambitions. You look at history and notice, this is where the Hindu writings are of very great value indeed. In the Puranas and such writings, you will find wonderful stories of great saints and sages who fell from the heights. And of course, in the English language, we have the marvelous poem by Milton, Paradise Lost, how Lucifer falls from heaven. The brightest star in heaven falls. Unworldly ambitions for equality with the Almighty. Have we a little more insight into truth? Now, insight into truth means that we are sufficiently awake all the time in our inner selves, and we are sufficiently free of all our all the defilements of the mind and the heart, and there are many. If we are free from all that and we are awake in ourselves, then we shall see truth everywhere. We shall see divinity everywhere and in everything. And if it is not manifested as true divinity, but is in an ill state, you will know why and how it is in an ill state, and how it can be transformed, transmuted into what is pure and good and beautiful. And when that sort of vision is there, then you will see truth now, here and now. And the implication of all this is the utter purification of the psyche and freedom from all selfness whatsoever. Then whatsoever you think and feel, speak and do will be good. And you will see that it is the good, because you yourself will have put yourself into rhythm, into harmony with the one total reality. And your life will be a benediction to the world in which you live.